Inoho, please be seated.
I've got to bow, sorry. That's not a good start, is it? But anyway, it gets better. So this morning we're going to be moving into an panelling of witnesses, and I understand that Mr. De Palsmaker and Mr. Wilson are first to present to the court and to people perhaps watching by AVL the schedule in particular, but the provisions around the schedule, which is good, and then we'll empanel the witnesses. I'm not sure how many people have been involved in a joint panelling, but really important that when you're speaking that you introduce yourself first so that the transcription service is capturing who is speaking. So you just have to say your name and that you're speaking. Second thing is, if somebody's already given an answer or there seems to be a general consensus around a point, not everybody has to talk if you're happy with that. You know, don't feel, you know, you have to say something for the record. You know, if somebody gives an answer which you're generally happy with but you think could be amplified, by all means answer that. Or if somebody gives an answer that you disagree with, then by all means you should answer that. But yeah, we don't have to go up and down the line, people going, yes, I agree, or no, I disagree. So we'll leave it at that, and with your witnesses, I think. Yep.
Your Honour. Now I call Mr. De Palsmaker and Mr. Wilson.
I do.
Could you each please state your full name for the record?
Tom Willie de Palsmaker.
Simon Shield Wilson.
And each of you have participated in expert witness conferencing on Schedule 10A4, the Controlled Activity and Restricted Discretionary Activity Rules, and Objective 10A1.1?
Yes.
Yes, I have.
And as a result of that conferencing, a joint witness statement was produced, and you are both signatories to that statement?
Yes.
Yes.
The original statement dated 4 to 6 May 2021 was supplemented following some further sensitivity testing, the outcome of which was recorded in Appendix 10.
Yes.
And an updated version of the joint witness statement was filed on Friday the 22nd? 21st. Friday the 21st of May.
Yes.
Do each of you agree that the evidence you're about to give is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Yes.
Now, for the record, both witnesses, Mr. Wilson and Mr. De Palsmaker, are agreeing.
Yep. Now, I understand that you have prepared a presentation for the benefit of the court and parties to this proceeding, outlining the progress that has been made in relation to key changes to Plan Change 7 recommended by the expert witnesses during expert conferencing, and you are to take the court through your presentation. Now, a copy of that presentation is on the screen, and I understand we have one participant, Ms. Stiles, who has joined us by AVL. So if you could take the court through. Good morning, Ms. Stiles.
Good morning.
If you could take the court through your presentation now and then remain for any questions.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honour. Good morning, Commissioners. Good morning, everyone. Mr. Wilson and I, we have prepared a presentation. And like the presentation we did yesterday, this presentation is basically intended to summarize the key outcomes that are stated in the joint witness statements or the various versions of the joint witness statements. We prepared the presentation for the court, but we also had a second target audience in mind, which is the primary sector stakeholders, the water permit holders, or the general public. And I believe that is in accordance with the court's wishes. And so for that purpose, we've tried to use plain English again. The matters that are discussed in the joint witness statements are sometimes of a technical nature, and where we couldn't avoid using technical terms, we've tried to explain them in the presentation. So as with the presentation yesterday, we've included a few slides at the end that explain technical terms. For example, in there, I've explained the difference between controlled activity, restricted discretionary activity, and non-complying activity status. I also outlined the difference in terms of legal status between the notified plan change and the version of the plan change that has been agreed upon through the expert conferencing, which doesn't have legal status. But I thought with that other audience in mind, the lay people in mind, it is important to make that clear as well. Now, I do want to apologize first to the court and to my colleagues. Mr. Wilson and I have prepared the presentation. We, because of time constraints, we have not been able to share this with the other witnesses. We tried our hardest to make sure that it accurately represents the joint positions and the joint witness statement. Right, I'll move on to the first slide. Because part of our audience is the general public, I thought it would be a good idea to start off with restating or summarizing the purpose of the plan change, because I believe that actually gives a useful context, and it provides some reasoning behind the controls and the measures that are proposed in Plan Change 7. So the purpose of the plan change is actually to allow for an efficient and timely transition to a new land and freshwater management regime that is to be established by a new land and water plan that needs to give effect to the NPS FM 2020 and needs to be notified by the end of 2023. Plan Change 7 seeks to achieve this purpose by establishing an interim planning framework. And that planning framework is actually based on two key pillars. There's more, but I want to draw your attention to the two key ones, which I believe is one, providing strong policy direction around limiting the consent duration for resource consents to take and use water. And that policy direction in Plan Change 7 trickles through into the rule framework as well, through especially the controlled activity rule. And also it tries to provide permit holders with a consenting pathway that is both cost-effective and allows for an efficient assessment of resource consents. And that consenting pathway is based on a controlled activity rule. Now, the plan change was notified well over a year ago now, and through the submissions and also through the evidence that was presented before the court, a number of amendments and changes have been proposed. Technical experts and planning witnesses have been able to consider these, and through the expert conferencing, we've agreed on a number of amendments to the plan change. And I just want to list the key ones up here. One is expanding the date range for determining the maximum area under irrigation. The other one is an amendment to the method included in Schedule 10A4 for calculating the rate of take and the volume limits that ultimately need to be used to determine the limits that reflect historical use. A third one is expanding the date range for water meter data used to calculate the rate of take limits and volume limits in new consents, so that when using the schedule, we can use all the available water meter data up to the 30th of June 2020. And the last one is an amendment to the rule framework within Plan Change 7 to make the plan change more process focused. Now, this is something that was presented an amendment that was presented to the court earlier before the expert conferencing, but I think that all the technical experts and the planning witnesses involved in conferencing agree on those changes. Now, if we take the version of the plan change with the amendments recommended by the technical witnesses and by the planning witness as a basis, I thought it would be useful to set out the key criteria that applicants need to comply with if they want to apply for a consent to replace an existing permit under the controlled activity pathway. The first one is the consent that is applied for should not be for a duration of more than 6 years, and that is actually consistent with what was in the notified plan change. The second one as well has not changed. The water permit or the deemed permit that you seek to replace still needs to be a valid permit. I've explained that term at the end of the slideshow. The third one, again, hasn't changed from the notified version. It requires that applicants demonstrate in the application that they seek to comply with any existing minimum flow, residual flow, or any other condition that restricts the taking of water that is currently on the existing permit. A fourth criterion is that in the application, it needs to be demonstrated that the rate of take and the daily, monthly, and annual volumes of water applied for should be no more than the maximum rate of take and volumes determined in accordance with the schedule, using water meter data up to end of June 2020. And the last one, the application needs to demonstrate that the maximum area that you seek to irrigate shouldn't be more than the maximum size of that area at any point in time between the period 1st of September 2017 and the date of notification of the plan change, which is 18th of March 2020. Now, some of the, two slides ago, I presented the four key changes that came out of the expert conferencing. Some of those, especially the ones around the increase in the maximum size of the irrigated area and the extension of the date range for the water meter data that can be taken into account, it's pretty self-explanatory, in my opinion, at least. However, the changes recommended to the schedule are a little bit more complex, and we thought it would be good to explore that a little bit more in detail in this presentation. And for that purpose, I'll hand over now to Mr. Wilson.
Good morning. So starting by outlining the purpose of the schedule, or what is the schedule? The schedule is a method for calculating limits for rate of take, daily, monthly, and annual volumes. It's based on the principles that it's simple, objective, and certain, so anyone running it will get the same numbers, and you can know going in what those numbers will be. Simple, leading to a low cost of processing. And it seeks to achieve two main things. One is that the numbers it comes out with don't exceed the current consented allocations, and that the numbers it produces reflect actual historical use. looking at the starting point first, because I think that's useful in understanding the changes. So we started with a date range of 1 July 2012 to 30 June 2017, so looking at 5 years of water meter data, and it generated limits based on average maximum. So it took the highest number in each year. If we take rate of take, for example, highest rate in each year, and averaged that across the 5 years to give a number. And it did the same for daily, monthly, and then for annual volumes as notified, it was the average of the annual volumes. The main concerns raised with that were that the data period chosen didn't represent a 90th percentile dry year, as in the ninth driest out of 10 years. That the use of average maximums produced rates and volumes which were not reflective of actual use, so that even if you had a dry year, you were then bringing the average down by including wet years or years where water wasn't available. And the outcome of that was that applicants will be left with less water than they needed in a high demand year. So we've recommended three main changes to address that. The first one Mr. De Pelsmaker has already talked about, but which is using all available water meter data up to 30 June 2020 under the controlled activity. Changing from average maximums to typical maximums, and I'll go into that a bit more in a moment, what the difference between those is. And a technical thing, but previous wording had removal of data above consent limits. Now we're adjusting it down to the consent limit, so there's more weight given in situations where consent holders have been overtaking. Are we not there? Sorry. Jump to the next one. So the difference between average maximums and typical maximums, and I have a slide in a minute with a picture to try and illustrate this, but an average maximum was taking the highest value recorded in each water year. That's June to July, or July to June, sorry. Averaging it, for some water users, that's a fairly consistent value. They use water fairly consistently. For others, that value jumps around. The typical maximum is taking the highest value in the record overall, as long as it's representative of the normal pattern of taking. And the key, from my perspective, being that we want to avoid setting limits based on data spikes. So if I move on to, I think this hydrograph illustrates it very well. There's a red circle there, where you can see that their normal pattern of taking is between 5 and 700 litres most of the time, with five spikes that are significantly above that. So we're talking about trying to get to a typical maximum, which is the highest number within that red circle. Somewhere around 700, while avoiding setting a limit based on one or two values, which in this case would take them up to an extra 500 litres per second. Most consents aren't quite this obvious. This is a pretty extreme example, but it's an example where if you don't have a process for defining what typical looks like, you'd have a limit that was an extra half a cubic.
And the red line here?
The red line is the consent limit. So consent limit's about 1,400 litres, it's slightly less than that, and normally they're not taking more than 700. So how do we do that? To run the schedule, the first thing an applicant needs is a copy of their hourly rate of take data, and I should say I've based this on the latest round of agreed changes. Applicants can obtain a copy of their rate of take data by contacting the council, which most do, or if they want their own copy to verify what we're providing, then their data provider will have a copy of that as well. We tidy the data by removing any records at or below zero. Below zero can be caused by meter errors and things like that, and it just makes the data untidy as you move through. Any measurement that exceeds the limit is now rounded down to the limit, and that step happens before any discussion on typical. The net result of that is going to be that if you have a consent that consistently overtakes their limit, their typical amount will be the limit because you've rounded all the values down. Then we run step four. To do that, you take the data set, order it by size from largest to smallest, and then look at how many water years you're analysing, which is D in the formula in the schedule, and then work out what your N number is. Now, N is the number of data points that need to be similar, need to be within the margin of error of your highest data point for it to count as typical. The formula we're recommending at the moment is 18 plus 3 times D, which in English is 21 hours of taking in your first year, and then another 3 hours of taking for each additional year that you're looking at, depending on the length of your record.
So why?
So increasing the number of data points over time is, in my opinion, important because the risk of spikes increases. So you're more likely to get spikes, you need to have a larger number on a larger data record, but the risk, you're also trying to deal with the fact that taking will naturally be higher or lower in different years depending on conditions. So we're not saying, you know, 21 points of data for each year. So it's increasing at a relatively soft rate. And we'll talk later on this morning, I think, about some of the testing we've done to get to the right number for that. The idea is that it's tuned so that it doesn't accidentally take away too much. So it's tuned in favour of the abstractor is the way I would describe it. Cover the margin of error, which I think we've covered previously, but 10% for open channel, 5% for pipe takes. And we have a template for this, so I say count, but I don't expect people to sit there counting. But count the number of values within the margin of error of the highest value on your data set. If that count is equal to N, then that's your highest typical maximum. If it's not, you move down to the next number and repeat the process until you get a number which is representative, which is close enough to enough other numbers. In practice on the spreadsheet, that looks like that. So you've got the date and time on the far left, the rate of take is the next column, and then N, or the number of values within the margin of error, is the next column. So in this data set, I've rounded the top four values because they were above the limit, and there are 11 points of data within the margin of error of those. So we keep moving down the data set until we get to near the bottom of the page where 142.5 litres per second is within 57 other data points, so that becomes the typical maximum. And I've just put a note at the top, we were looking for 27 points of data. So you can see, I mean, it's important to understand that using hourly rate of take, there's about 8,000 potential numbers in each year. So we're cutting off the first 15 of probably about 24, might be 4 years, so 32,000 points of data. And you can see that the record gets denser the lower down you go. So the highest maximum has 57 similar data points, the next one has 73, 85, and it keeps going until it hits a sort of plateau. Courtesy of Dr. Bright, this is another sort of image of the steps and how it works. So you run your first step, rounding numbers above the volume down, above a limit down to the limit, and then you run your second step, which is step four in the method, to look for your typical maximum. So a number can be above the limit, rounded, and then rounded again to get to the typical maximum. For daily volumes, so that was rate of take I talked through before. For daily volumes, you do basically the same thing, except the formula is slightly different. And in English equates to 3 days of taking for the first year and 2 days for each additional year thereafter. And the extra step at the end, so rate of take is a self-contained thing. You find your highest typical maximum and that's it. Daily volumes, we use the data set. So once you've found your highest typical maximum, you round anything above that to the highest typical maximum. That becomes your filtered data set. And then you sum that to find the amount of water you've used in each calendar month, and your highest calendar month is your maximum monthly volume, and use the same data set to find the amount of water you've used in each water year, and your highest water year is your maximum annual volume. In practice, because all that is getting fairly complicated, the council intends, when a consent holder contacts us to ask for their raw data, to provide them with an initial run of their typical maximum numbers, which would allow entry into the control pathway. They will also provide templates, should they desire, which will allow them to check the workings. But if it produces a number that they're happy with, then we'll have given them enough to lodge an application. And now back to Mr. DePalswick.
Thank you. Over the course of this hearing process, we've been presented with a number of scenarios, scenarios in which water permit holders cannot get entry into the controlled activity pathway, or they do not want to meet the entry conditions for that pathway. The expert conferencing has given the planning witnesses a chance to consider those scenarios and to formulate a response in terms of a recommended consenting pathway that addresses those different scenarios. What I've done in the next couple of slides is just in one sentence try to summarize those scenarios and the agreed planning response between the planning witnesses set it out as well. So it's very much presented as a Q&A kind of type slide. Again, for the benefit of lay persons. So one scenario or two scenarios that we considered was, what if a water meter is installed and you want council to consider either data beyond 30th of June 2020, or you want council to consider other data or other methods as well that might help to ground truth or complete the picture around historical use. So in that case, we recommend a new RDA pathway to be available to those water permit holders. Another scenario is where people have been granted an exemption to meter their water take under the 2010 water metering regulations, and where people, as an alternative, want to use, again, alternative data or alternative methods such as Aqualink, TopNet, gauging or synthetic flow data. In that case, it is also recommended to give people access to a new RDA pathway. However, if you haven't been metering your water take in situations where you should have had a water meter installed, either under the regulations or under your consent requirements, and you want to use alternative data, then the intent would be to have people applying for new consent under the non-complying pathway. Allowing for consideration of other data or other methods to calculate historical use, that option is really to complement existing water meter data. It is not to substitute it or to ignore it. Earlier on in the process, council also recommended that the controlled activity pathway should be available for people that are not required to meter their take under the regulations, because it's a small take under 5 liters per second. We recommended that the controlled activity pathway should be open to those permit holders. It's not something that we explicitly discussed in the expert conferencing, but I think there's a general agreement on that matter as well. And I thought it would be good to include that in the presentation as well. Now, two scenarios that relate more to the size of the irrigated area. If people want to extend the size of the irrigated area beyond what was irrigated in March 2020, but they've already installed pipes or infrastructure to allow for an expansion, they just haven't been able to irrigate an additional area. A proposal was presented to the court to allow for that as a controlled activity rule. We considered that in expert conferencing and came to the conclusion, yes, that is a valid circumstance that need to be provided for, but it is probably better to consider this under an RDA pathway. If people simply want to extend their irrigated area beyond what was irrigated in March 2020, and they haven't committed to any investment, that should still be considered as a non-complying activity. And that being said, so those are just the slides with clarification. I won't take you to it. But with that being said, we've arrived at the end of our presentation, and we're happy to take any questions.
Rather than throw open questions for you two in particular, for probably what we'll do is empanel the witnesses, all of the witnesses. But thank you very much. That was a very clear explanation of something which I know in many parts is extraordinarily technical. So well done you, and well done actually the experts. I know you know who've gotten us to this position already, and that's, I can say that, even though there is still some debate which is happening in the court. So thank you, and we'll just empanel the remainder.
So those witnesses who are joining the panel, if you come forward.
Do you want to have planners sitting together? And technical people sitting together?
I had thought that we might have the two council witnesses in the middle and then the planners to the left and the technical people to the right, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Minimise the amount of mic sharing.
Yeah, on this, I think there's three seats.
Right.
Sorry.
Yes.
Good morning, Ms. Stiles. Can you please confirm you'd like to make an affirmation?
Yes, please.
Do you solemnly, sincerely and truly declare and affirm that the evidence you give should be the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
I don't.
Thank you.
Good morning, witnesses. I thought we might commence with each of you confirming your full name for the record and confirming that the evidence that you are about to give is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief, which I think you can do by saying I do again, so full name and then I do if you agree with that proposition. And we'll start with Ms. Stiles and we'll work our way along the panel.
Stephanie Stiles, I do.
Ben Farrell, I do.
Sally Ann Dicey, I do.
Sandra McIntyre, I do.
Yes.
Good. Tom Willey, the postmaker, I do.
Simon Shield-Wilson, I do.
Paul Michael Mitchell, I do.
Christina Elise Bright, I do.
Matthew Aaron Hickey, I do.
Thank you. Now, before I start with my questions, I think we now refer to Dr. Bright as Dr. Bright, your PhD having now been conferred. We will
you
do
hang on to that conferment. I think we'll call you a doctor.
Yes, you'll have to get used to it. Now's a good time to start. What I propose this morning is to ask you as a group a series of questions, and those will be open questions with a view to achieving some dialogue between you. In the first instance, focusing on areas where there remains some disagreement, and I'll be starting with the objective for that purpose, and then I intend to work through the balance of the joint witness statement, not clause by clause, but planning provision by planning provision, if that makes sense. So I'll step through some of the recommendations that have been made with respect to the controlled activity in the RDA. We'll touch on stranded assets, and then I'll have some questions about the schedule, and those will be questions of clarification, noting that agreement has been reached by the experts in relation to the contents of that schedule. Just a reminder, when you're giving an answer, if you can give your name so that the transcription service can correctly record and identify who's giving the answer. And if you do have a contribution to make in addition to that which another witness is making, perhaps flag to me by moving your arm in a way that I can recognise, and we'll make sure that those of you who have something to say have an opportunity to add to that. The final thing I'd note is that there are microphones on the table. I think we've got one down the end there. We've got a fixed one there. Just make sure that if you are speaking, you are either in front of the fixed mic or you have the cordless microphone in front of you. Ms. Stiles, we can see you quite clearly on the screen. I'll make sure that I'm giving you an opportunity to speak if I can't see your hand raised from where you're sitting. So I'd like to start with the objective and the work that's been undertaken in relation to that objective indicates that two versions of the objective have been recommended, and each of you fall within one of the two camps, noting that some witnesses simply don't have a view on the objective. What I thought I would do is to start with option A, and just the two options are set out in the track change version of the plan change, which is attached to the joint witness statement. And I would invite a representative from the group of witnesses who support version A of the objective to explain the recommendations made with respect to that objective and to highlight in the first instance what's sought to be achieved by the changes being recommended. Now, just in terms of support for version A, paragraph 5 of the joint witness statement records the initials for the witnesses who are in support, and correlating the names to the list, we have Lionel Hume, Sally Dicey, Matthew Tews, Claire Perkins, Alex King, Vaughan, where's Vaughan? Hodgson, Stephanie Stiles, and Tim Ensor. Now, Ms. Dicey, I had understood that you had drawn the short straw, and perhaps you might lead off.
Sally Dicey, I didn't realise I had, but I'll definitely lead off. Looks like I have now.
Would you like me to take through you through all of the changes, or just where there's a difference between the different versions?
Yes, just focusing on where there is a difference between version A and version B.
So really the only difference is the linking at the end in version B to not compromising the ability of the new land and water plan to give effect to the MPSFM 2020. So that wasn't included in version A. And the reasons for that were twofold, really, and they were covered in paragraph 5 and paragraph 7 of the joint witness statement. And so the first one, at paragraph 5, is that I thought, and I believe the other experts have signed up to that too, and Ms Stiles will speak to that in a minute, I'm sure, was that it is difficult, if not impossible, to ascertain whether an objective achieves something when that something doesn't yet exist. So measuring the achievement of an objective against a land and water plan that hasn't yet been prepared is difficult, if not impossible. So that was one of the key drivers for not including that reference there. The second being that there was some concern that might be applied to a six-year permit as well. So somebody coming in under the controlled activity rule, there was potential that a consent officer might pick up an application and assess it also against whether granting a six-year permit may limit or prevent a new land and water regional plan from giving effect to the MPS in terms of even just the kind of conditions that might be attached to it. So there was some concern around that, and I note that Ms King had added her name to that, I think, from a consenting perspective.
When you think about the explanation that you've just given about concern of applying an objective referencing the future land and water plan and the NPS, is there a particular matter of control that gives rise to that concern? So when you think about how a consent might be processed.
Potentially in relation to historical use and just ensuring that historical use is actually historical use and no other kind of thinking gets pulled in, that would probably be the most critical one.
So just so I've understood, the concern is one where a council officer may...
Sorry, can I add to that as well?
Yes, please.
Also through the RDA rule, where of course there is discretion to decline. So with opening up that RDA, the restricted discretionary rule further, the potential for a consent officer there to, assessing allocation and what is a history of use, particularly where the data is not quite as clear, and other methods might be being brought into play, then there could be either potential for that discretion to be applied, taking into, with that kind of consideration, or for a consent to be declined, potentially. So just really closing down that kind of risk.
Okay. Ms Stiles, is there anything you'd like to add in addition to the reasons Ms Dicey's given?
Stephanie Stiles. Yes, if I may, for myself and I believe a couple of the others who put their names to version A, it was really a lot about the ambiguity of the ability for anyone to know what could be deemed to be compromising the ability to give effect to something that is at this point in time unknown and will be evolving in its development over the next couple of years to culminate in the new land and water plan, and essentially the ability through any of the considerations under any of the activity pathways under this plan change to just simply not know what might constitute compromise or not.
Are there any other planners here today who were in support of version A?
Sally Dicey, no, I don't believe so. I would also just add to Ms. Stiles that was the key driver. The second component was more of a residual kind of consideration. But no other planners with that from that perspective.
Okay, we'll hear from the planners who support version B, and when providing the explanation around version B, please feel free to respond to the reasoning which has been outlined in support of version A, just so we can understand what the thinking is.
Tom Lepalsamaker, I will start off. The key reasoning for Ms. McIntyre, and I understand also maybe Mr. Farrell now, to support version B, myself as well, is because the addition at the end provides context, extra context. I think it's important to have that last sentence, not compromising the ability of the new land and water plan to give effect to the NPS 2020, because it puts context around how the existing activities can continue to operate in the interim period. That is really the key reason. That is especially important, I think, because the objective will be taken into account for activities that are going to be assessed under the non-complying rule as well. And it drives you back to a precautionary approach, applying a precautionary approach when setting consent durations.
I'd like to hear from the other planners in support. Ms. McIntyre.
Sandra McIntyre. Just adding to what Mr. De Pelsmaker said, if I refer you back to my supplementary evidence, which I think was of the 17th of March, at that point in commenting on the latest version of the provisions that we were looking at that time, I proposed an amendment to Objective 10A, which was it, 10A23, because I was concerned at that stage that there wasn't strong enough, clear enough direction as to how to consider non-complying activities and what they needed to be assessed against. The policy, sorry. Yes.
Not the objective.
Yes, that's right. And my recommendation at that time was that wording very similar to what we have incorporated here in objective. And the objective was put into the policy. And you may recall that under questioning, I agreed with Ms. Baker Galloway that it would actually, there would be merit in lifting that up to the objective, because essentially what I had put into the policy was very focused, was about what the overall purpose of the plan change is. So that is a big part behind my thinking in terms of putting that in the objective. In response to the matters which Ms. Dicey has raised, first of all, in terms of the extent to which this might get in the way of considerations under the controlled activity and the restricted discretionary activity pathway, in my opinion, there is not any real chance of that happening. In both versions of the objective clearly states that we are looking to enable existing activities to be maintained for the interim period. In the controlled activity, there is no opportunity to decline consent. The restricted discretionary activity, the discretion is very clearly restricted to just whether the information provided clearly represents historical use. So I don't see that there is any real risk that reference to giving effect, well, compromising the ability to give effect to the MPS would get in the way of that. In response to the other reasoning that Ms. Stiles and Ms. Dicey have put in, I'd note that, in fact, the wording doesn't require that it be assessed against the ability to give effect to the new land and water plan, which I agree is not there at the moment, so you can't do that. What the wording actually says is that it's about assessing whether the ability for the new land and water plan to give effect to the MPS is compromised. And in my opinion, you can actually assess that directly against what the outcomes are in the MPS. And so seeing what those outcomes in the MPS are, you can look at whether a particular activity might compromise the ability to give effect to that. So I don't see that as a problem in terms of the assessment. I'd just like to make one further note that we've identified this morning that there's a word missing in version B. In the final part of the objective, you'll see that in version A says including by enabling existing activities, and the word including has been omitted in version B. That should be in there. Mr. DePausmaker and Mr. Farrell and I have conferred on that. We all agree on that. We haven't had the opportunity to just check that against the other people who agreed to that, but certainly it's our understanding that that was the intent.
Mr. Farrell.
Ben Farrell. The only matter I would add is to reinforce, I think, a statement Mr. DePausmaker said. And as I said in my supplementary evidence after the JWS was prepared, I dislike version A in respect of the fact that it has no bottom line or outcome that a decision maker considering a application for a long-term duration would then assess the application against, and therefore it would slant the outcome towards efficiency.
Ms. Stiles or Ms. Dicey, do you wish to respond to any of the reasoning given by the witnesses in support of version B?
Sally Dicey, with regard to a non-complying activity, I mean, that's opened up to kind of all considerations under Section 104. So the MPS will inherently come into play in that consideration. So, again, I just see it as redundant wording and potentially confusing in terms of, you know, what we're actually assessing applications under this plan change against for the controlled and RDA pathway. That's all I'd add.
Ms. Stiles, anything further?
If Ms. Stiles, no thanks, nothing further from me.
Staying with the objective for a moment, Mr. Farrell, you raised in your comments on the joint witness statement a flag in relation to the words "and timely" and whether those words actually were capable of having any real meaning, or whether perhaps they might be substituted for some other wording. Would you like to elaborate on the concerns you hold in relation to particularly the word timely?
Mr. Ben Farrell, to me the term "and timely" is, just adds ambiguity. I'm not sure of the intent or direction or outcome or benefit that those words actually add, and if they were deleted, I don't think that would actually affect the intent of the wording. It may do, but I haven't thought about what else could be used, and just acknowledge that I wasn't part of the JWS that came up with that.
Those of you who were in attendance at the conferencing, was there any discussion around the word "timely" and what it meant?
Not to my recollection. We were asked, Tom de Pulsmacher, we were asked to consider three paragraphs of my evidence in chief, which included those words, efficient and timely. The reason why I used the word "timely" in my evidence in chief is because ultimately what Plan Change 7 tries to do is achieve the outcomes set in your new land and water plan, or allow for the transition towards those outcomes, but also do that in a manner that is consistent with the time frames for achieving those outcomes, again, set in your new land and water plan.
Sally Dicey. From memory, there may have been some discussion, maybe I just thought it and we didn't discuss it. I can't remember. There were a couple of long days. That the timely, and possibly just in with the word "efficient," was about setting up the transition, a timely transition to a new land and water plan. And so that was kind of a clear framework for the six-year term. But again, I don't think it's something, the word "timely," any of us would die in a ditch over.
I'm going to move on beyond the objective now. Are there any final comments that any of the witnesses wish to make in relation to the objective before we move on? Now, I don't propose to spend any time on the policies today other than having you confirm that no consequential changes were recommended to the policies in light of either version A or version B of the objective.
Sandra McIntyre, that's correct.
I want to move on to the controlled activity now, and as I read the joint witness statement, I understand that there's agreement that the reference for the data period to be used has been adjusted again, such that it's any data up until June 2020. And the planners have recommended that change, which is highlighted grey in the track change version. Now, have I understood that that is the position which has been reached?
Tom de Pulsmacher, yes, that is correct.
Uh, And the reasons for that change have been set out in the joint witness statement, and I don't intend to take you through those reasons. The other change that has been recommended in relation to the controlled activity and I will just stay on the controlled activity, relates to the matter of control, which references the historical water take rates, volumes, etc. And there were some questions asked in relation to the wording used. And in particular the phrase within the limits of, and there has been a recommendation that that phrase be substituted with the phrase in accordance with historical use. I'd be grateful if one of the planners would perhaps just touch on the rationale for that change and what the intended outcome from that change is.
Sandra McIntyre, I can have a go. since nobody else is putting their hand up. In looking again at the question that had been raised about whether the wording within the limits of historical use was clear, we agreed that it possibly wasn't, and that in accordance with historical use, as was initially included in the rule, was potentially less open to interpretation. However, in looking at it, we decided that there was a bigger issue there, and that the wording of that discretion needed to be clarified to make it very clear what the intent, that the intent was essentially to be able to assess the data in terms specifically of whether it accurately represented historical use. So essentially the modifications we've made there are intended to make that entirely clear.
So one of the concerns that had been raised throughout the hearing with the previous wording was a concern that the matter of control and or discretion might give the council the ability to set a rate of take that is below the historical rate of take. If I've understood the JWS correctly, that concern has been addressed such that the outcome is one of reflecting historical use as opposed to having historical use as the upper bound within which limits could be set. Have I correctly picked that up?
Sandra McIntyre, that's correct.
Now, those were the only two changes recommended to the controlled activity rule. So I'll move on now to the restricted discretionary activity rule and the changes recommended there. Now, when I look at the matters to which the council will restrict its discretion, matter A has been recommended to be deleted, and a replacement matter A with two parts has been recommended. If one of you would perhaps highlight the reasons why the recommendations have been made for the change in relation to matter of discretion A, and then I have some questions about the wording which has been recommended.
Tom de Pelsmaker. With regard to matter of discretion A, similar concerns were raised around this matter of discretion as were previously discussed around a matter of control. It could give council the ability to set limits in new consents that would be below historical use. So the change in the wording is in part informed by the need to address that issue. The other thing what we wanted to make clear is that council should have a discretion to consider what other data or what other methods can be accepted to build that picture of historical use.
Ms. Dicey.
Sally Dicey. Yeah, I just add to that that I was anticipating that there will be circumstances where data is not considered representative, particularly within the time period. That is, you know, even the period over which data may have been collected quite legitimately still might not represent a particularly dry year or a year of high demand, or there may have been legitimate issues. And so it sought to recognise that other methods could be used which would could help complete the picture of what might be or might have been historical use.
And Sandra McIntyre, just one point to add to that. The other thing that we were asked to consider, I think, was whether the reference to other data and methods was potentially could be applied more broadly than in relation to historical use, and so we agreed that it potentially could be, and so the wording in this matter for discretion is intended to very clearly confine consideration of those other methods to the question of whether it accurately reflects historical use, not to matters such as efficiency and demand.
Now, when I look at the wording that has been recommended, there is a small part of that wording that has caught my eye, and those are the words, as agreed with council. Now, with my lawyer's hat on, when I read that phrase, I read that as reserving to the council a discretion to determine by subjective formulation what data might or might not be included in this assessment. And I would be interested to understand what the thinking was behind the use of this phrase and whether its use was discussed.
Sally Dicey. I think we did have quite a detailed discussion at one point in the expert conferencing about that, and we had asked the technical experts whether certain kind of methods would be acceptable or and useful and valid, robust, to establish historic use in the place of water metering or complementing water metering data. And they came up with quite a long list and said that it wasn't exhaustive. We did canvass the idea of including a list or some examples. And I do think one possibility to make it clear would be a non-exclusive or non-exhaustive listing of some methods that I think there was agreement from the technical experts. And I don't think that there was any particular disagreement about that possibility. I think it was potentially just tidy, efficient drafting, but yeah, acknowledge that that could lead to risks for disagreement.
Sandra McIntyre, just to add to that, I think in relation to the point you've raised about allowing a discretion for the council, my recollection is part of our discussion that was part of the purpose for putting those in. This is a restricted discretionary activity. And that is a matter that it is intended that the council specifically have discretion over. We discussed this point specifically with the council's consents team leader, Ms. King, who was there, and she was of the view that this was an appropriate way to formulate that.
Mr. De Pelsmaker?
Yes, I agree with both of my colleagues, actually. I raised previously in a previous round of expert conferencing some concerns around the drafting, not the intent, the drafting, and I think clarity is always a good thing. So I agree with Ms. Dicey. There might be some benefit in providing guidance around what types of data and methods could be used. I also agree that it's probably difficult to make an exhaustive list that includes all types of data or methods, but that would actually constrain or limit the risk of disagreement between council as well.
Do the words "as agreed with council" actually add anything to this matter of discretion when you read it in its entirety?
Sally Dicey, potentially not, because with a rule where there's discretion, there's always going to be that discussion with the council anyways, and if the council doesn't accept it, then they don't have to grant the consent. So, yeah.
Any other contributions in relation to this recommendation before I move on? Mr. Wilson.
At the risk of crossing the line, I think just to reflect that the discussion we had as technical experts was that there was a range of things that could come through as other data methods, and we thought it was important not to close the door. The control pathway is fairly narrow. Our idea behind the RDA was that people had more options to get through it. I think secondly, just to reinforce that even if you were to provide a list, there are some examples, say synthetic data, for example, where you'd still have to make a quality judgment, even if you'd listed it, on whether the synthetic data method was appropriate or not.
And so the wording which picks up on other relevant methods and the wording that those accurately reflect or represent historic use would achieve both the flexibility in terms of which options might be appropriate, but also a safety net in terms of ensuring that the method, the relevant method chosen, does accurately reflect the historical use.
Some of us, yes, I think so.
Now, the next topic that I want to move on to is still under the umbrella of the restrictive discretionary activity rule, but that is the part of the joint witness statement which deals with the issue of stranded assets. Now, recommendations aren't tracked into the track change version of the plan, but there are some words provided in the body of the joint witness statement. Starting at or around paragraph, just below paragraph 59 on page 14, the joint witness statement. Now, the witnesses jointly were invited to consider some wording that had been put forward by Strathclyde Water Limited, and you were also invited to consider whether the fix, such as it is for stranded assets, might better be included in the restricted discretionary activity rule. And you've stepped through what each of those options might look like, and at paragraph 64 you've set out what the additions to the restricted discretionary activity rule would look like to address the stranded assets. My reading of the joint witness statement is that the planners recommend that the appropriate activity status is restricted discretionary. Now, have I distilled that correctly from the statement?
Sandra McIntyre. We did have quite a bit of discussion about this particular thing, this particular matter, and part of that discussion was a little bit over exactly what the scope of the matter that the court was asking us to consider was. And we weren't clear whether the court was actually asking for our opinion as to whether this was a matter that should be included and provided for, but whether it was a matter that, if the court was of a mind to provide for it, what is the way in which it should be provided for? And it was that second construction that we thought that we were considering, so we looked at it in that respect. In terms of the matter of whether or not bespoke situations like this should be provided for in the plan change, we didn't have that specific discussion, and I think there were probably different views around the room on it, but we specifically didn't discuss that. We looked at if it was to be provided for, is it better provided for as a controlled activity or a restricted discretionary activity? We agreed that if it was to be provided for, then an RDA rather than a controlled activity would be preferable, and that it could be done in the way that we've described in the joint witness statement. And that's as far as our discussion went.
Ms. Dicey, and I'm asked about who might do it, but I'd be interested if you could expand upon the thinking and the reasoning behind why you collectively were of the view that restricted discretionary activity was perhaps more appropriate.
Sally Dicey, I'm not sure if I'm the best person to answer on that behalf. The thinking was about, because it was a kind of confined point of difference, that actually is a point of difference. That's what the RDA rule is seeking to capture. However, and this is why I'm not potentially the best person to speak for putting it in the RDA, I do note that because it is confined potentially and clear, then potentially the controlled activity is would be okay, bearing in mind or referencing the comments at paragraph 63, that in Strathclyde particular situation where they're just one shareholder of a scheme, putting it in the RDA does make it difficult because it potentially pushes a scheme with, say, 300 water users into the RDA category for only one of their shareholders, and that might be quite a challenging discussion for that one shareholder to then ask all the other shareholders to come along with them through a process where there's potential for a decline. So I do kind of retain that nervousness about the using the RDA pathway, but it was about it just being a bespoke situation.
Tom de Pulsmaker, I agree with that.
So when looking at the wording that's been recommended, some of you will have had the benefit of having heard questions put to a range of witnesses in relation to stranded assets, and the impression that I certainly took from that evidence was that the recognition of irrigation main lines would pick up on those who had invested but not yet turned on the irrigation system. In terms of the wording put forward, did you spend much time considering whether the way in which the stranded assets have been described in the wording will respond appropriately to the situations which we've heard about throughout the hearing?
Sally Dicey, yeah, there was some discussion around the definition and a clarification around the mainline infrastructure, and so most of our discussions centred on that because that was the particular example that the court had asked us to consider,
And so there was quite a lengthy discussion and some input from the technical experts and where we landed, including, I think there was a the definition was intended to make that really clear. We did acknowledge very briefly, again, as Ms. McIntyre said, because we weren't asked to consider other scenarios, that there will be other kinds of investment that have been legitimately made already, such as ordering of trees or perhaps starting building a dam, or that won't be captured and then allowed for with this particular wording. But we didn't spend any time on considering that.
Now, you'll have to remind me where the definition had been added. I have read it.
Tom De Palsmaker, paragraph 60.
There it is, thank you. Are there any other contributions anyone would like to make in relation to the stranded assets recommendation?
Sandra McIntyre, just briefly, and I think it's one of the difficulties with considering this is the matter that Ms. Dicey has raised, is that this is one possible scenario in terms of stranded assets. There are a lot of potential different scenarios that there may be, and that was certainly, in my view, one of the reservations I had about trying to provide specifically for a particular scenario in the plan changes, because it's a little bit like, you know, picking winners. It's providing for one bespoke situation when there might be a whole lot of other bespoke situations. So that, I suppose, as a caution that I have in terms of providing for this in the plan change.
When you think about the response, as planners, are you of the view that in this context the plan needs to be responding to factual situations on which the court has received evidence?
Sally Dicey, yes, and I think they have received factual evidence on other situations.
Perhaps you might just remind me of what situations there might have been that wouldn't be covered by this wording.
Sally Dicey, so again, it's the ordering of trees or vines or posts or, yeah, those were the ones that I think have been addressed by others, and I think, and I can't recall, I'm sorry, exactly the nature of it, but I think the evidence of Ms. Ma on behalf of Beef and Lamb also attempted, and I don't know whether that covered factual situations or just a planning response. I do remember her evidence covering something similar to this.
Mr. De Palsmaker?
I think I agree that we've heard from other situations, but there's probably two things I want to point out. This has been, to my recollection, specific relief that has been brought forward or has been proposed, so that's why we considered it. Also, what I've heard in the previous weeks of the hearing is that often this solution may actually provide for the other situations that Ms. Dicey rightfully so has pointed out, because the irrigation, the mainland irrigation pipes, are often installed sometimes years ahead of when the actual expansion will take place. So usually it's at the start of the development of the whole property. They set the infrastructure in place that will provide for the different staging. So I think there's a possibility that we will also provide for some of those alternative situations.
Sorry, Sally Dicey. I think Beef and Lamb, it was a specific relief set out in their submissions. And I would just caution around assumptions. I'm certainly not qualified enough or an expert in the field of how people set up future developments. I do know that in some cases trees or vines or things like that can be ordered several years in advance. So I just caution assumptions around mainline pipes being put in always first.
When you reflect back on some of the evidence given for those who had invested in particularly, have in mind cherry trees, some of the evidence was that the area on which the trees were being planted had been irrigated in the window of 2017 to 2020. So whilst the infrastructure wasn't necessarily in place for the trees in that context, the area itself had previously been irrigated and thus would fit within the existing controlled activity pathway. Is that something that you perhaps had on your radar?
Sally, do I see that? Definitely rings a bell.
Well, yes, I think I'm going to move on to the schedule next, so now's probably a good time.
Okay, so we'll take a quarter of an hour break. Thank you. All rise.